That was not on the table.
Correct.
Okay, good.
We're about to celebrate Purim, and the Purim that happens in Shushan that we read about in the Megillah actually forms the basis for a discussion starting from classical sources and going through historical sources about something very interesting. The community of Lepanto sent a question in Italy, sent a question to... You are taking...
You just rang a bad bell.
Go ahead.
Because I'm not a student of history, and I remember only one historical fact among all the abstractions that were presented to me.
Go ahead.
And that was the date of the Battle of Lepanto, which was 1571.
1571. Okay, this predates that.
Okay. But I know nothing. I don't even know where Lepanto is.
It's in Italy.
I would figure it ends in a vowel.
So they wanted to know, the Jewish community in Lepanto wanted to know whether they could institute a day of celebration that was binding upon them and upon the members of their community and their descendants forever and ever. Just as they instituted a Purim in Shushan that was binding, they wanted to know whether it's possible to institute a Purim in Lepanto, which was binding. So they sent the question to the Maharam Al-Ashkar, that's Rav Moshe Al-Ashkar, who was originally Egyptian, I think, and then he went to Tunisia, and finally he settled in Yerushalayim, or Tunisian, and then went to Egypt, and finally he settled in Yerushalayim. He was one of the great halachic authorities. I believe this was in the 1300s. He was one of the great halachic authorities of the time, and he corresponded with many of the other great halachic authorities of the time, and he addressed the issue in this tshuva that we have here in the first source. She'ela, anshei ir achat heim, right? Lepanto she'ela, anshei ir achat heim. They are one, there are people in one city. Uveit dinam tiknu b'nehem b'charamot u'b'haskama gdola, and they decided with a cheren, right? If you violate this, you'll be excommunicated. And they all agreed. Alehem ve'al zaram, ve'al kol hava'im achareihem, me'ata ve'ad olam, them and their children and everybody after, forever and ever. La'asod et yom echad asar yom l'chodesh shvat, to make the 11th of Shvat, ki'yom purim l'chol dvarav, as a day of Purim for everything. Kedil afarsem neis echad gadol shena'asa lehem ve'oto yom. To publicize a great miracle from which they benefited, and make that a day of Purim. Uvichlal takanatam hitkinu, and in their decree they instituted she'afilu mi sheyishane et mekomo ve'elech lishkon be'ir acheret. Anybody who moves from that city and lives in another one, lo yasur me'alav chok hatakanah hi ad olam. And they are not free to deviate from this decree, and they have to celebrate the 11th of Shvat as well. So Yoreh HaMoreh, so they're turning to the Maharam Al-Ashkar. Tell us, teacher, Im yesh koach biyad anshei ir achad letaken keyotze b'zeh olo. Do they have the ability to institute this kind of celebration? Well, we don't know exactly, or it's not clear from here exactly what it was that happened in the city of Lepanto that would cause them to celebrate this this miracle. So they want to know, do the rabbis of the city have the ability to make this kind of decree? Im takanatam takana, im yuchlu ligzor af al ba'im achareihem olo. And if this is a valid decree, can they institute it for further generations or not? And if it's possible for them to institute this for anybody that comes afterwards, now that everybody has been banished from that city and has been mixed up in other countries and other kingdoms and so forth, whether they really have to, they want to know, do they have to fulfill that decree there or not? So he goes on and he says, "Vaday yicholin hem bnei ha'ir l'taken bnei hem." Of course they can. And they can also make anybody go for other generations. And they can institute fines on anybody that violates this decree. So we see that there is a concept. So we see that there is a notion, and that there is a concept in halacha that a community is allowed to institute its own private day of Purim. Apart from, of course, the regular Purim, any community that experiences any kind of miracle is allowed to institute their own Purim. The Magen Avraham quotes this as well. Yecholim bnei ha'ir l'taken ba'askama u'becherem aleihem. Right? Any community has the right and the power to institute with the force of any kind of binding decree. La'asos purim b'yom shenasa bones. To make a Purim on the day that you were the beneficiary of a miracle. And let's say that somebody had a miracle that happened in the month of Adar. Mi shenasa bones b'Adar. La'asos purim. If you want to make a Purim in other, yesh omrim la'asos bo b'shnasa ibor b'other sheni, v'yesh omrim la'asos b'other rishon. So then there's a discussion whether you should make that in the first other or the second other, if there is a day in other that you had a personal or that the community had a miracle.
Purim, what does the word Purim mean?
Purim means, the Gemara, the Megillah says it. It means lots. Al Kain, right? Al Shem Hapur, because of the lot. But Purim has become not just a, it's become a noun, meaning it's a noun referring to the day of Purim. And
it's become a generic term.
Correct. But it's a term for Yod Dalet or Tetvav Adar, right, that we're celebrating this weekend. But also, it's become, it was used to describe any day celebrating a miracle.
And what day did they want to put it?
This was the 11th of Shvat.
Far removed.
Yeah, you could have it any time.
Okay, and do we know what...
We're going to learn in a little bit about a Purim that takes place during the 3 weeks.
What was, do we know what that miracle was?
Yeah, we don't have
the... No, we don't know.
We don't
or let me just... I don't know.
Okay.
I'm sure it is known.
But this was...
I don't.
But Hanukkah could have been called Purim too.
That's true, but Hanukkah and Purim are different.
But it's also the miracle of the light.
Well, Hanukkah was celebrated differently.
What
I mean to say is that the way these Purims are celebrated is the same way that we celebrate Purim, through feasting. Hanukkah is not... Hanukkah was a spiritual salvation, not a physical
kind of celebration.
That's right. Now, we find, actually, the historian, the bibliographer, Mort Steinschneider, made a list of... He was the first person to make a bibliography of Purims that are celebrated by different communities. And he made a list of something, I think it was 23 different communities celebrated their own Purim. But there are others who had more extensive lists. One list had 29. I think in the Encyclopedia Judaica there are 100. So there are many communities that celebrated their own private, individual days of Purim. So today we're going to talk about one or two of those. One of the... a Purim that was celebrated by a family. First Purim that we're going to talk about is the Purim that was celebrated by a family. That was the family of the Tosfos Yom Tov, of Yom Tov Lipman Heller, the Tosfos Yom Tov commentary on the side of the Mishnah. And Yom Tov Lipman Heller was the Rav in a number of places. He was the Rav in Prague, and then I think in Lvov, Lemberg, and then in Krakow. Now, he had a very difficult life, and already in the time that he was in Prague, he began to make enemies. What happened was, now, Rav Yom Tov, anybody ever heard of the Council of Four Lands, Vivad Arba Aratzos? It was a decision-making body from the four different major regions in which Jews lived at the time, Galicia, Volhynia, I think, and other such regions, in which they made a number of binding decrees upon the Jews there. And Rav Yomtov, it was made up of Rabbanim, the council. And Rav Yomtov Lipman Heller was a member of the Vad Arba Aratzos. Now, Rav Yomtov Lipman Heller was the chief rabbi, the Av Beis Din of Prague. He was among those that voted in favor of a tax that was instituted upon the Jewish community. And this was a graduated income tax. So the percentage of the tax, the majority of the tax, fell upon the wealthiest Jewish citizens. It wasn't just for the Jewish community, but it was the majority of the tax fell upon the wealthiest Jewish citizens. So they began to, so one wealthy Jew began to circulate a petition or spread rumors that he, Rav Yomtov Lipman Heller, was spreading anti-Christian propaganda in the context of his sermons, in the context of his writings. And this was believed. And so he was put in jail. And while he attempted to appeal his sentence, he was later sentenced to hard labor. And he was in jail for, I think, a month, and then he was released on condition that he never live in Prague again. He had to leave Prague. So eventually he ended up in Krakow, but these charges caught up with him. And once again in Krakow, he was imprisoned. Now, this was around the time of anti-Habsburg sentiment that was boiling up. And he was, I think, viewed, since he was coming from Prague, he was viewed as something of a seditious character. So the story, so he tells the following story. This is a story that he writes. His son, Rav Shmuel, was one day sitting under the tree in a forest, studying. Sounds very Hasidic, right? Go into the forest. He was learning Torah under the tree in the forest, and he heard strange noises coming from somewhere in the forest, and he runs, and he sees that there is a terrified woman standing there wearing red, being charged by a bull. So he immediately pulled the woman aside, threw the red cape that she was wearing at the bull, and the bull ran away. And he saved this woman's life. And she was so overcome that she told him, please come back with me to my home. I must reward you for what you did. So she takes him back to his home, the son. And he sees that this woman is not just any woman, she's a baroness. And the baron wants to give this boy lots of money. He says, no, I refuse to take this money. So he says, well, if there's anything that I can do to help you, let me know. So when Rav Yomtov Lipman Heller is rotting in jail, the son remembers this baron who had influence with the Kaiser, and so this baron pleaded on Rav Yomtov Lipman Heller's behalf, and everything turned out okay. Now, on the day that Rav Yomtov Lipman Heller was released and was able to assume the position of the chief rabbi of Krakow, he did the following. This is what he writes. Now, he has a whole book that he published about the events, about all of the difficulties that he encountered, because he was really persecuted relentlessly. So really, he was persecuted. That's okay. He was persecuted relentlessly in the context of his various rabbinic activities. So he writes as follows. This is the last paragraph of his, I guess you could say, monograph. It's about 18 pages long, describing the events. As kol divrei ha'igeres hazov asher kasavti lachem. He's writing this for his children, right? Umara isi al kachal asher kabati yom tzom. So as a result of that, he instituted, on the day that he was released, a day of fasting. The ata hine lo ratziti likvoa gam yom yishteh the simcha. I really did not want to institute a day of
right.
drinking, and a day of happiness. Omnam kein hineni achshav ani koveh gam yom yishteve simcha. But now I am actually going to institute a day of happiness and a day of rejoicing at Yom Echad L'Chodesh Adar, the first day of Adar, Rosh Chodesh Adar. L'dor Adeichem Ad Olam. He's talking now to all his descendants. Forever and ever, we are going to have a private Purim. Alai V'Al Banai Uvnotai V'Chatani V'Chatani V'Kalotai. My sons-in-law, my daughters-in-law, he, I think, had 10 children. I think 6 daughters and 4 sons. So, or 4 daughters and 6 sons. So all of his sons-in-law and all of his daughters-in-law and their children and so on and so forth. Ki bo v'yom chazra ha'atara le'yoshna. The crown returned to its former glory. Li'yot ha'vezdin v'ram b'kila kedosha u'gdola kraka. That I was able to return to be the head of the rabbinical court and teach Torah in this great community of Krakow. Gam HaGalil Shoah, and also the surrounding region of Krakow. Val Kol Sivotea, and really the entire sphere of influence of Krakow. Kein Yizakenu Ha'el Yisbarach L'Shar Tov, V'La'avdo, God will let us serve Him and to be His and to truly worship Him. And my mandate now is not to, and none of this is for any kind of payment. I just want to behave the way God wants me to. Until Mashiach arrives, amen. So this was the private Purim. I believe that there are descendants of Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, of the Tosfos Yom Tov, that even to this day commemorate his Purim by having a special kind of feast on the first of Adar. They have a special private Purim. There's another Purim that was celebrated on the 20th of Adar. This was a Purim that was called Purim Vincens. This is alluded to in a number of halachic works. One of the halachic authorities of Frankfurt in the 1600s was later than that also was Rav Yosef Yuspa Han Nordlingen. He wrote a book called Yosef Ometz, which is a halachic work, and he talked about Purim Vincens. Is Tanit Vincens, and then followed by a day of celebration. What happened in the year 1640? Just by way of background, in the early 17th century, there were tensions in Frankfurt between the members of the guilds, right, the workers, the working class, and the patricians, the upper class. And the patricians dominated the city council in Frankfurt. So the guilds that were what do you call the downtrodden of the proletariat, to use the terminology of another Jewish person, right?
Karl
Marx, right? So they felt like they were being marginalized because they weren't as well off, and that led to considerable unrest. The guilds wanted to participate in government more. They wanted to have more of a say in the setting of urban and fiscal policies, and they also wanted to make sure that the Jewish community's rights would be restricted in order not to provide any kind of competition to the guilds. That's how it came to be. Often the Jews were moneylenders because they weren't allowed to practice any skilled trades. The guilds would prevent them from joining. In 1612, Emperor Matthias became the emperor. He was elected to be the emperor. And the city council rejected the guild's demands. And what they wanted was, they wanted to read aloud the privileges given to the city of Frankfurt, the imperial privileges. So a baker named Vincent Fetmilk, fomented an uprising. And of course, what happens when you have, these were seemingly two groups that had nothing to do with Jews, right? The guilds, there are no Jews in the guilds, and the patricians, there were no Jewish patricians. So of course, what happens? Blame the Jews. So Vincent Fetmilk led an uprising against the Jews. And it was called the Fetmilk Rebellion. They rose up against the emperor, and it was mainly craftsmen, bakers like him, who rose up against the city council. And in fact, in 1614, a pogrom began in the Jewish ghetto, the Judengasse in Frankfurt. That was, at the time, Frankfurt had, even then, had a large Jewish community, and they were in the ghetto there. The ghetto in Frankfurt came down in the 1840s, I believe. But the community kept growing, and the ghetto wouldn't expand. They refused to allow the ghetto to expand. So they led a pogrom in the Jewish ghetto in Frankfurt, and the emperor had to call in reinforcements, people from Mainz and from Darmstadt, neighboring areas, to come in and restore order. So on the day that the pogrom stopped, they instituted a tannis, and then they instituted a day of celebration. And that was on the 20th of Adar. So in his discussion, his halachic work, Yosef Ometz, Rav Yosef Yusbach Han Nordlingen, discusses the obligation to fast on Tanis Vincennes. That's what he calls it, the Tanis that they instituted for the day of Vincennes. And in fact, and this was binding on all the citizens of Frankfurt. Who was a famous citizen of Frankfurt? I mean, there are many, but who was a well-known Jewish citizen of Frankfurt, let's say from the mid to late 18th century?
Uber.
Sorry?
Not Uber.
Think more religious.
I can't think of it.
The Chasam Sofer. Moshe Sofer, he was from Frankfurt. He would sign all of his correspondence Moshe Sofer me Papdam, Frankfurt de Main. Right? Because there are two Frankfurts, right?
Frankfurt de Main.
And Frankfurt an der Oder. So he was from two Frankfurt.
Oder.
Exactly. So,
Oder.
Exactly. So he was from Frankfurt am Main, and he signed his correspondence. And his son wrote that his father continued, even about 150 years later, almost 200 years later, his son continued to observe, his father continued to observe this Purim, the 20th of Adar, as a day of Purim, even that many years later. There's another example of a communal Purim that later was observed by individuals, even if the community didn't observe it. Although I think that maybe the community in Frankfurt did continue to observe that one. Let's look. This is an article.
How long this went on? Did they celebrate it that day? I mean, as the descendants continued, you know, the new generation, or did they just?
I think that the observance may have petered out at
some point.
Let's look at page 290. There's an article by the historian Eliot Horowitz about, it's called Innovation of Tradition. It's about communities that innovated traditions, and this is found especially in the context of instituting days of Purim. look in the second paragraph. Eliyahu Kapsali was a halachist from Crete, from Candia. Candia now is the town of Heraklion. Right? So Candia, he lived there. He was a well-known halachic authority. He corresponded with many other halachic authorities of the generation. In the summer of 1538, on the island of Crete, which had been under the rule of Venice for three centuries, so the fleet of Suleiman the Magnificent began to was under the threat of attack. He writes, "The Jews of Candia, which was the largest community on the island, were called upon by the Proveditori to participate in civil defense work, including the digging of trenches, an assignment which happened to fall on the fast day of the 17th of Tammuz, commemorating the breaching of the walls of Jerusalem prior to the destruction of the first and second temples." So now what to do? It's Shibasar B'Tammuz. So is there a way of getting out of this labor? So Eliyahu Kapsali turned, so he had just been elected the head of the community, and he wanted to have, he wanted to find a way to get out of this, especially because it's not exact, you know, so Shibasar B'Tammuz is in the middle of the summer, if you live in the northern hemisphere, right? And in the Mediterranean,
hot.
It's very, very hot. Exactly. And on that day, and that didn't work. When his efforts proved fruitless, he ruled that all of the men who were digging trenches would be permitted to postpone their fast until the following day. That year, Shibasar B'Tammuz was on Shabbos. So Shibasar B'Tammuz was a nidche, it was pushed off to Sunday, and so the men would be fasting on Monday, and therefore, really on Sunday, that 18th of Tammuz, you could only find men, women, and children, women and children and elderly people who were found in the Jewish quarter there.
Where were the others?
The men were digging trenches.
Oh, they were.
They were called into the service. Now, right around that, now on that day, there was a rumor that went around. The rumor went around, possibly because of a sermon in one of the local churches, that the Jews were actually hiding Turkish spies. And as a result, a number of the people on the island began to storm the Jewish quarter. So he writes as follows. Kapsali's first response as head of the community was to announce, as a means of pacifying the hostile intruders, that anyone who had seen Turkish spies and failed to report them would have all of his property confiscated. They could do that. They were a communal organization. More slyly, as he himself later acknowledged, Kapsali surreptitiously encouraged the Jewish women to react as hysterically as they could, thereby making the situation unpleasant, if not unbearable, for the horde of unwelcome visitors. And then finally, he brought in the governor to stop the disturbance. So he, Kapsali, was very worried about what would happen, and he said that he felt that there was the hand of God in the story. And he didn't think so much that it was the hand of God that this fabulous governor came along, but rather he writes that it was that the Jewish, that the young boys, right, who were all hot on fire, they were spoiling for a fight, said that the real miracle was that they restrained themselves. Otherwise, there is no doubt that the young men, especially the braver and more belligerent among them, would have provoked the Gentiles and would have drawn their swords, which all had in their homes. Right? It was a different time. Jews had swords. In their foolish and vainglorious desire to flaunt their valor, they would certainly have harmed one of the Gentiles, which would cause the entire community to be massacred without exception. So he felt that there was no doubt that his people would have caused this pogrom. They would have brought it upon themselves. So he wanted to institute a day of celebration for having been delivered from the hands of the marauding band of locals. But he didn't do it right away, because who knows what would happen? The conflict between Venice and between the Turks was still going on. And only the summer after the peace treaty was signed, that was in the year 1540. So then, on Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, he gathered the community together, and he said that from now on, the 18th of Tammuz, that was that Sunday, would be a day of merrymaking and happiness and feasting. Now, he never used the word Purim. He never used the word Purim to describe it. And not only were you not allowed to fast, he said, you're also not allowed to work on the 18th of Tammuz. Now, it's interesting to note that the 18th of Tammuz is what? What is the 18th of Tammuz?
Well, Shiva Sava Tammuz.
Right. So what does Shiva Sava Tammuz start?
That starts the destruction of Jerusalem.
Right. It's the 3 weeks, right?
The beginning of the 3 weeks.
So that's usually a period that's associated with what?
Mourning,
right? So you would think that having a day of celebration, having a day of feasting might not be...
It's punished.
Right, exactly. So that just shows how strong it is. That this was a day that was so important that they were still able to have this kind of day of celebration. Now it seems to be that this kind of celebration was relatively restrained. And the reason for that is that it happened during the 3 weeks, and they were cognizant of the fact that it was probably a better idea to temper it a little bit, just out of acknowledgement that that's what the day is about.
Could have changed the date.
Chatzi Hallel.
Chatzi Hallel.
No, they could have changed the date too.
Well, if they change the day, then the whole thing becomes an artifice.
Ah.
Right.
That's like President's Day. Nobody was born on President's Day.
Right.
Right. So, and there are many other accounts of this Purim occurring on the 18th of Tammuz, and this is another example of a communal observance of Purim.
But they didn't call it by that name.
He never used the word Purim.
Why would he? I mean, how did this word originate actually in the other communities?
Well, because the idea of Purim is a celebration from physical harm. And that's what all of these days are as well. There's celebrations of deliverance from
physical harm.
Oh, from death.
From death.
From death.
Okay.
I don't know if you're coming to it, but Lubavitch celebrates the day that the Alter Rebbe was released from prison.
They have a whole parallel series of what they like Yom Tovim, the day that the Rebbe was released from prison, the day that the day that the Alter Rebbe was released from prison.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Right,
yeah.
The Baal HaTanya. And the day of the current Rebbe became the Rebbe. That's another day that they celebrate. The day that they got back the books, right? The Rebbe's books. His nephew, the previous Rebbe's nephew, was
Barry Garari.
Right. It was a court case.
Yes.
And Nat Lewin was the right. And so they celebrate that as also kind of a yontif. I don't say Purim because none of this. Right.
Because
why?
It had nothing to do with
right deliverance. Right. Now, there is even a Purim that is celebrated by one family, a reasonably notable family. If anybody knows the Frimmer family, this is a Purim that Rabbi Norman Frimmer writes about, the Frimmer family Purim.
Where is that?
So the description is not in this... But it is actually on your source sheet, on the first source sheet.
On the first page.
Yeah. You probably, I'm sure you remember, I was not alive then, but when the B'nai B'rith building was in Washington, D.C., was stormed and the people inside were taken hostage in 1977. March 9th, 1977.
I've got a big blank on that.
Norman Trimmer was among those who was taken hostage.
Really?
Uh-huh.
So this is
accurate. Who stormed the building?
Iranians, I think.
Iranians?
I know that was the American embassy, but this was, I think it was also...
Not sure.
I'm not sure who it was, but...
Foreigners or something?
You think so. So he was among those taken hostage. Now, he writes as follows. They were held hostage for 30 hours, I think. So during one of those unidentifiable moments of anguish, I resolved, like Maimonides, he quotes in this article, a prayer that the Rambam uttered when he was being attacked, that if he ever, if anything terrible ever happened, if he gets saved from this terrible fate, then he would dedicate himself, he would celebrate. So during one of those unidentifiable moments of anguish, I resolved, like Maimonides, that if and when I were ever liberated, I would not forget that day of terror. I would fast upon the 20th day of Adar, corresponding to that faithful Thursday, and ask my wife and family through the Frimmer Family Council. That was, I guess, they had meetings that they called the Frimmer Family Council, to establish the day of our miraculous rescue, the 21st of Adar, exactly one full week after the regular Purim, as a Purim Katan for our family. Their family celebrated their own Purim, and later they even had a series of prayers that they would say. They had chapters of Tehillim that they would say. They would all get together for a feast, for eating and singing, and they would sing parts of Hallel, and they would recite certain chapters of Tehillim. And this would be binding, he said, as long as he, Rabbi Norman Frimmer, he would do this. He had to fast, and this was binding upon his children and grandchildren and so forth, so long as he is alive. After which point, I think they could decide whether they want to continue to observe it or not. Again, you have here an example of a modern Purim celebrated as a in the same spirit of Purim, which we celebrate our deliverance from harm. We have a modern person who is celebrating Purim in the same way, his own personal Purim to mark his own deliverance from harm. So we see that there is a precedent for communities, and there are of course many, many other examples. This article by Elliot Horowitz has examples of something like 7 or 8 other communities that celebrate their own Purim. The community of Narbonne celebrated their own Purim, but a fact that is overlooked often is that the problems that the community of Narbonne experienced, we won't get into it now, came up as a result of what was likely the murder of a Christian fisherman by a Jew. So it tends to be overlooked. But there are many communities that celebrated this kind of Purim, and it's just something to note that when we celebrate the Purim, we aren't just celebrating our communal deliverance, the deliverance of the Jews in the time of Shushan. We aren't just celebrating that, but in a certain sense, we are celebrating our own physical freedom and our own ability, and of course, and our own ability to overcome those who torment us. And of course, we say the pasuk, and that's really almost a tefillah, v'na'apohu, right? That there was a decree, v'na'apohu, and the decree was reversed. Asher yishletu ha'yehudim heima bisonehem, that the Jews would overcome their enemies. Really, it should say, in a certain sense, because it's talking about the past, it say asher shaltu ha'yehudim, that the Jews overcame their adversaries. But the fact that it says yishletu, that they will, right now obviously there are grammatical reasons for this, but I think that also in a certain sense, yishletu means that they will overcome, shows that this is something that happens all the time, and that when we are able to overcome our enemies and our adversaries, this is something that is worthy of celebration in the appropriate way.
Tell me something.